defendant would say, well, I just, I was just, you know, doodling, and I didn't have any intent to pass it.
Well, this is what we're specifically saying, as I understand on the prescription thing, that we're making possession of a forged prescription a crime, whereas passing it will not be a crime. So we're trying to do specifically what George is arguing against.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I'm not necessarily taking a position on it.
I know you're not, but I'm saying that I don't think that the inchoate crime section is sufficiently broad enough to embrace this particular type of a possession offense.
Well, the answer to that would be, rather than have you decide on the basis of the definition, the specifics, I would rather see you cure the definition in the inchoate crime section rather than decide as a policy matter for that reason only that you ought not to adopt the inchoate crimes approach.
Well,
in other words,
yeah,
this section in the Model Penal Code could certainly be improved to encompass anything you want to.
I tend to agree, and that's the objective of our being here, to try to broaden this in a cohesive...
Don, was there anything in the commentaries on the New York Code that explained why they used the language they did in defining written instrument?
Yes, in fact, I commented on that a few minutes ago. Yes,
They
were trying to restore the common law, broad
yeah.
definition of writing, mm-hmm. what they're trying to do. Now, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak with what
Fine.
Professor Platt has brought up now, with respect to court crimes. Now, at the time we were doing burglary, and we talked about possession of burglar's tools, when we did the final draft on that, I believe we put a comment in there that we realized that this might be covered by inchoate crimes and as an attempt. But that we were including it with the understanding that this would have to be reviewed by the commission later in light of the draft on inchoate crimes. And I certainly think from the standpoint of structuring this proposed criminal code that the general approach through the inchoate crime article is preferable over a hit-and-miss specific type of statute in each case. I think that not only with respect to this draft we have here today, but with respect to burglar's tools and any of the other possession-type offenses that we should give serious consideration to adopting the Model Penal Code approach to it. I think there's a lot of merit in that.
I'm still hung up on the same thing I believe that bothers Frank, and that's that normally you think of a forged instrument as being one which the person intended to utter. And you come into Section 4, and in effect it makes a crime to have in your possession something which, if uttered, would not be a crime.
Well, look at this. Now, I can write down, I am a good guy, Judge James M. Burns.
No one would ever tell that.
Okay,
forgery.
I haven't committed a crime by writing this, but now I've written it and I intend to give it to Graham. Okay, now while I've had it in my hand, I'm committing a crime. Not by writing it. While I wrote it, I was committing any crime. But while I had it in my hand, I was committing a crime. But when I gave it to him, I'm not committing a crime. I mean, I think that's wrong. If it's not a crime to make it or to pass it, why is it a crime for me to have it in my hand?
Well, that's the reason that I wonder about the definition of forged instrument.
Yeah. Well, and this is the only way we're going to
subsection
get
8
in as a crime. You say it's
yeah.
not a crime to write it out. It's not a crime to pass it, but only while the guy's got it in his hand. With the intent to, I mean, you've got to have the requisite intent to utter it sometimes.
Judge Sloan, do you have any solutions?
It doesn't make sense to me.
I know. Jake Tanzer or Harry have an answer for it.
That's right.
I mean,
well, I think
your possession of a forged. Of something that's got to be forged, there's got to be something capable of your uttering it being the crime of forgery. I think the court is going to rule that if they ever get.
Well, don't you think forged instrument, the definition of forged instrument defines an instrument that's capable of refused to commit a forgery.
Okay, then this would not be my possession. This would not be a forgery. But we just said here that I'm prescription. It wouldn't be a crime to write it out. It would be a crime to pass it because there's no intent to injure this fraud type of situation. But it's a crime while you're possessing it. My opinion, no work prescriptions or any other type of writing in on crime of possession, it's got to be a crime to pass it somewhere.
Forged instrument is a very broad definition. It means a written instrument which has been falsely made, completed, or altered. And the intent to utter is absent.
But the intent to utter is set out in section 4, though.
Maybe
yeah, there's no reference to utter in 8.
Maybe if you get it this way, Mr. Chairman, now this is sort of spitballing, but maybe we reach the problem of the uttering of this particular thing if we change the definition of forged instrument means a written instrument which has been falsely made, completed, or altered for the purpose of defrauding or injuring another person.
Well, then you would run into exactly, you'd run right square into the deal. The word deceived or misled not being in there. And in a prescription, there's no injury or defrauding.
Run it back down the flagpole.
Yeah. Yeah, let's recess for 5 minutes. We've gotten hung up by Senator Burns' introduction of the prescriptions. I think he has a comment or two at this time that may solve it. We don't want to foreclose any discussion of it, but we would like to get through with forgery if we could.
We're going to solve it, Mr. Chairman, by making a provision that none of these crimes are punishable in Washington County.
I like that one. That's better than the counties over 300,000 we're so used to.
All right. Well, I think we are hung up on prescriptions, so would the commission be amenable to this sort of an approach? Number one, we will send the question of forged prescriptions back to subcommittee. We'll have the commentary show that insofar as this draft is concerned, assuming that you pass on it favorably today, it's not intended to cover forged prescriptions. And number two, to get to the inchoate crime, a problem that George has spoken to, and which I think makes tremendous sense, and to reserve this business about criminal possession to the inchoate crime article, and understand that I'm not saying that, in my judgment, the model penal code inchoate crime article is necessarily acceptable, but we can revise that. But with that in mind, Mr. Chairman, if the commission would think that it's in order, I would move to delete Section 4, criminal possession of forged instrument in the second degree, Section 5, criminal possession of a forged instrument in the first degree, and Section 6, criminal possession of a forgery device. Would be your intention that all three of those sections would go back to subcommittee? Well, it would be my intention that that all three of these would go over into inchoate crimes. Mm-hmm. That we would send these to George Platt and with the instruction that these are the kinds of things that we feel are intended to be covered in the inchoate crime article, but that the question of forged prescriptions can go back to Bruce and Bob Chandler and Doug Graham and I to look at again, and maybe to die a peaceful death there. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman?
Another day.
I may have a hang-up on this, but I wonder, could the subcommittee also just look at that language in Section 1, definition of written instrument?
Okay.
I really wonder if that adds anything to it, and I think it may be a Pandora's box we don't want to open.
Well, we think it does add to it. At least I do.
Are you on the subcommittee, Bruce?
Yeah, that was the intention.
There you go, Dean.
George, is that satisfactory to you?
I would second Senator Burns' motion.
Is there any further discussion? If not, all those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. We'll turn to Section 7.
Section 7 really is one of the minor provisions in this article.
Simulation.
And that is simulation.
I thought it was stimulating.
Yeah, that's there's no T in that. This is similar to Model Penal Code Section 224.2. This has been adopted by some of the other recent codes. Michigan pointed out, and I quoted from Michigan, their commentary that, of course, this isn't the kind of a problem that in this state probably that some of the more populous states have, but it's intended to cover art objects and antiques and this type of property. And they point out the preparation here is usually a careful one, and a lot of money is usually a great deal of money at stake, and that it's difficult to apprehend the criminal this nature after the crime's been committed, so this was placed into this forgery article.
Seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that with respect to subsection 2, we ought to do the same thing, namely that if we're going to throw these possession situations over to inchoate crimes, we ought to put subsection 2 in the same transfer category.
We've got a little different situation with subsection 2, though. If he utters it, but he has to possess it with the intent to defraud, so the only way to defraud somebody with it is by using it in such a way.
The possession part of it, though, it still smacks for the same thing we talked about.
Well, the problem we had on the other one, that it was mere possession without the intent to defraud that created the crime, it seems to me.
Yeah, here the prosecutor would be trying to prove an uttering. He might fail in that. And if he's got something substantial on the guy, he could still have enough to get the jury on possessing.
Except for intent to defraud, I'm all in favor of this. It just wipes out my wife's painting classes, though.
This isn't intended to cover various cosmetic devices, is it, which are sometimes...
They're objects, yeah. Any further comment on Section 7? Not Section 8.
Section 8, fraudulently obtaining a signature. This is from the New York Revised Penal Law and the Michigan Code. This covers the type of situation which would not be forgery, because the document that is completed is what it's actually ends up is what it purports to be, a document executed by the person who had authority to sign it. So this is intended to get at the individual who obtains the signature, bona fide signature, under false pretenses.
Don, it might be appropriate to read the minutes from the subcommittee on that. When Don read them before, did you follow it, and did it help you in putting it in perspective? Once or twice so far this morning, he's read excerpts from minutes where the subcommittee discussed some of these things at length. Did it help you, or is it just hard to follow? Go ahead and read it.
All right. On
page 10.
October 18th, again, subcommittee number one. Fraudulently obtaining a signature, Mr. Platt explained that the only existing law close to the provisions of Section 8 was contained in ORS 165205, having to do with false pretenses. The conduct covered by Section 8, he said, would not fall under the preceding forgery sections because the document discussed in this section was executed by someone who had the authority to do so. An example of the type of conduct intended to be covered, he advised, would be an actor who fraudulently persuaded the maker to sign a check which was complete except for the signature. Chairman Burns reviewed the OMFP draft and noted that the commission had done away with the requirement for a false token. He asked if anyone could conceive of a situation under Section 8 which would not be covered by OMFP. Mr. Palat replied that in doing away with the false token, the phrase, quote, or who obtains or attempts to obtain the signature of any person to any writing, the false making of which would be punishable as forgery, unquote, which is now contained in ORS 165.205, had not been retained in the draft sections. Mr. Chandler cited as an example of the type of thing which would be covered by Section 8, a situation where someone prevailed upon Aunt Minnie to change her will to leave her money to him rather than to the Oregon Historical Society. In that example, Chairman Burns said Section 8 would be putting the district attorney into a civil lawsuit. Mr. Platt expressed doubt that this would be the result to any greater extent than under the present false pretenses statute. Falsely obtaining a signature to a will would now be criminal under ORS 165205, he said, and Section 8 would not make any great departure from present law. Chairman Burns inquired concerning the phrase misrepresentation of fact. There could, he said, be a misrepresentation of law and suggested that the words of fact be deleted. Mr. Paulette replied that he had not intended to make the term as broad as the definition of deception. Now that deception was defined in our theft draft. Mr. Spaulding said he would oppose deleting, quote, of fact, unquote, in Section 8. Mr. Paulette suggested it would be possible to prohibit the kind of conduct Section 8 was most concerned with, where there was an intent to defraud or injure by omitting the second statement referring to a misrepresentation of fact. Representative Elder asked what kind of a set of circumstances would be required to prove intent to defraud or knowledge that the instrument was false. Mr. Chandler replied that the proof of intent would rest entirely in the minds of the jury. Mr. Paulette said that in most cases the kind of evidence the district attorney would have in the absence of a confession would be circumstantial. Representative Elder expressed concern that Section 8 might have a direct effect on insurance adjusters, for example, who were daily faced with the problem of obtaining signatures from clients, and adjusters could not always have all the facts surrounding every situation before the document was obtained on the release, the signature was obtained on the release document. Chairman Burns suggested Section 8 might more appropriately fall within the consumer protection statutes. Mr. Chandler was of the opinion that fraudulently obtaining a signature should be a crime and should be included in the criminal code. He commented in response to Representative Elder's concern that before an injured party could prosecute an insurance adjuster, he would have to persuade the district attorney and in some cases the grand jury that he had a cause of action. After further discussion, Mr. Chandler moved, seconded by Mr. Spaulding, that Section 8 be approved without amendment. Motion carried. Representative Elder abstained from voting because while he was in favor of the concept of Section 8, he wanted to have an opportunity to obtain more information on the subject before voting. All right, and that's the end of the discussion on this section.
Professor Black?
Tom's touched on this a little. I'm really troubled, but I think without being able to have at my fingertips the definition of theft by deception, I don't see any difference between theft by deception as it's already been defined in this particular description. Is there a difference, Don? Do you recall it out here what it would be?
Yeah, I'll let me just be curious. It's more of an inquiry card. Yeah, maybe you could find it quicker.
It seems to me, initially, that this is not a typical forgery situation. This is a false pretense, deceptive practice that would, I think, fall under the theft definition that's already adopted.
Well, the commentary says the signature is not property.
Under theft.
As defined by the theft draft.
Well, if a salesman tells me, makes misrepresentations of fact with respect to the value of an article that clearly he knows to be wrong, and I write out and sign a check paying him for the article, he's stolen money from me on the grounds of deceptive false pretenses, not on the grounds of forgery. I think that that's within our theft definition. And here, of course, is the point I tried to make earlier, how closely forgery and theft run together. I raise the point because I don't want us to get into a perky situation where the state's attorney has got an alternative, perhaps, for the same kind of conduct.
Well, George, if theft by deception is approved, I think, by the commission, a person who obtains property of another thereby commits theft by deception when, with intent to defraud, he creates or confirms another's false impression of law, value, intention, or other state of mind which the actor does not believe to be true, or fails to correct a false impression which he previously created or confirmed. And there's several more subsections.
Well, what's essentially, maybe I don't see it, but I don't see any difference here between that and this.
Well, isn't there a difference in theft by deception? It presupposes the obtaining of property as a result of the deceitful act. And the crime of fraudulently obtaining a signature is more in an inchoate state. It doesn't necessitate the obtaining of the property. It goes to the situation where you make a misrepresentation of fact so that the old lady signs her will over to you and you're apprehended before she dies and before the property can pass to you.
Well, that was our concern, yes, whether or not that... Now, our definition of property is this, that it means any article, substance, or thing of value, including but not limited to money, tangible and intangible personal property, real property, choses an action, evidence of debt, or of contract. And we were concerned as to whether or not the signature would fall within the definition of property.
This is... Michigan says with respect to this, it's section 4025. Section 4025 reaches preparation for what may ultimately prove to be theft by deception, when the thing to which the deception relates is not a written instrument within the meaning of another section. Its chief application is to counterfeited paintings and other objects of arts, antiques, books, manuscripts, archaeological artifacts, musical scores, and the like. The section is patterned on New York revised penal law so-and-so and the model penal code. A completed transaction falls within the false pretenses statute if the victim parts with money or other property, and within attempted false pretenses or larceny by trick if the criminal makes use of the simulated object unsuccessfully. At an earlier stage, his activity would probably be viewed as preparation only. Since, however, the preparation of this sort of object shows careful advance planning, and since the monetary stakes are often very high, it appears appropriate to penalize the preparation as such, particularly when apprehension of the criminal after the final frauds have been perpetrated is often very difficult. A misdemeanor level punishment is indicated because the conduct is essentially preparatory to the ultimate crime. So that's somewhat along the lines that you're mentioning, George, and I think that's the very reason that the subcommittee put this in. Isn't that right, Don?
Well, yes, that's... We just weren't sure whether we'd be leaving a hole if we didn't have this thing. But since it is specifically covered now by ORS 165205.
Bud?
Well, I have a slightly different problem, Mr. Chairman, in connection with this section. Two things I want to at least bring up. One, the language to me looks awkward here at the end. By means of any misrepresentation of fact which he knows to be false. So if you're going to put in which he knows to be false, and that's what you're getting at is his knowledge, isn't it representation of fact which he knows to be false? Or don't you want to say his knowing misrepresentation of fact? It bothers me to say misrepresentation of fact which he knows to be false. Now, the other thing I'm wondering now is, are we intending to cover conduct which would be in a little bit different context than perhaps in contract law? Are we intending to cover conduct which, both types of conduct, fraud in the inducement and fraud in the execution?
Right, we're intending to cover fraud in the inducement here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and fraud in the execution.
Well, so fraud in the execution would be covered under theft by deception, providing that the...
not necessarily. I may misrepresent something in order that you believe and I know is false, and you willingly sign an instrument in knowing exactly what it says. What about the case where I get you to sign the same instrument by saying, sign three copies of this, and I lay it down so the signature line shows in three places. You sign the first, read it, and intend to sign it. The second one is a different instrument altogether, which you sign, and the third one is the same as the first one. But the second one is the one thing I really want to get, and I There, that's broadening the execution, as I understand it, because you're signing something different than you intended to sign.
Yeah, but that's theft by deception.
No, we haven't paid anybody. If that's what you understand fraud and the execution to be, then
well, that's one species of fraud.
Yeah.
I would think both of those situations would be covered by.
All right, but we do intend to cover both. I think that's for sure.
I have a question. Is this intended to cover the common garden variety roofing and siding contract?
Well, that's why I got asked about fraud and the inducement.
Because while I don't think very much of some of the roofing and siding contractors I've seen, I'm not at all sure that we want to add so much more to the burdens of the district attorney by swooping this kind of thing. And yet, as worded, I would think that any person who signs up one of those contracts and then later is disappointed could come barging right into Frank Knight's office and say, I want to issue a complaint against that company or that person.
So it depends probably no MFP. You've got to have the false token. You can go around making all kinds of false representations and stuff. If you've got present, you've got to have the false token, which is very frustrating having somebody really going around with an organized type of fraud but not really presenting any false token. And we've gotten away from that in OMFP, which really opens the door anyway, as far as the people coming into the DA every time they've been roofed on anything. And so I don't think we're creating any greater problem for the DA by adding this. It's already open anytime somebody has been defrauded.
But whatever we intend, both in the execution and so on, I think it should go into this section, into this chapter, or whatever you want to call it, forgery.
Well, I had made the suggestion in the subcommittee that we give Senator Wilner another $100,000 and this could go in the consumer protection bill. No, seriously, they go in, that it be covered, because we talked, it does show in the minutes, we talked about the roofing and siding contractors. However, we decided that it probably appropriately should fall here.
Well, I had a case last week. It was a civil case, and that would be a perfect example. The plaintiff said that the siding had cut down their heating cost by, I forget, 40% or whatever it was, and which clearly didn't. And if you pass this, I think that plaintiff last week could very well have been up in George Van Hoosen's office demanding the issuance of a complaint.
Well, that's the point that I started out to make. You and I are in agreement.
Well, I'm not. I don't know, but all I want to. The point I want to make is, if we want to swoop that type of thing in as a crime, bear in mind the burden that you are placing upon mainly the prosecutor.
Sure you are. It's clear.
Well, he's paid for the siding, but he's up in the DA's office anyway under your back situation.
Well.
So if we're really not adding a great deal to that by putting the signature situation in, because once they pay, they pay part of it. They usually, in those deals, they always get a substantial down payment. So they're in the DA's office anyway under our OMFP now.
Perhaps so. Perhaps we're not. If we're not adding to that burden.
Don, Mr. Chairman, could I ask Professor Plant, with respect to his inchoate crimes article now? Does your definition of an attempt get far enough in the preparation stage to include this kind of conduct anyway? In other words, would it be an attempt to obtain or attempted theft by deception under your inchoate crimes, falsely obtaining a signature to a document if the actor intended to go ahead with to obtain property thereby?
Dealing with DDS, that it would be, and if that's close enough, substantial step within the course of criminal conduct for the completion of the crime, here that's a problem with the fact, recognize what the difference between preparation and intent. This is one reason I'm somewhat hesitant, is this is one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult section in the whole Inchoate Crimes article, defining intent for the purpose of distinguishing it from mere preparation. But as you put it, I think this would be an attempt. Here you define it really as a completed crime,
yeah,
but in a great sense it's an inchoate crime too. So is burglary. There are a lot of inchoate crimes that we now describe as a completed crime. Burglary is a fair example, breaking and entering with intent to commit another crime.
What is your pleasure? At least I think that language should be cleared up. I think Senator Lent is right.
Would do violence to any drafting instructions, drafting technique you've been following, to say by means of knowingly misrepresenting any fact?
No, it wouldn't cause any drafting problem.
By means of knowingly
misrepresenting any fact.
Or how about by means of any intentional misrepresentation of fact?
I think either word, the way we commonly use it. I don't
think knowingly probably is better.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's good.
Well, I'll move your amendment if you want me to. Mr. Chairman, then I'd move the amendment suggested by Senator Lent to provide that the Section 8 read, in the last clause, he obtains the signature of any person to a written instrument by means of knowingly misrepresenting any fact, period.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried.
And then I would move the adoption. Well, we're going to move it all at once.
Section 9.
All right, now, Section 9 gets us into the use of slugs. Really, it's intended to combine several existing statutes. We define the crime, and then we have definitions in sub 2, definition of coin box and slug. And coin machine is defined, we hope, broadly enough to include any type of vending machine that would take not only coins, but also bills or tokens. And we've defined slug to include not only what we commonly think of as a slug, but that could be used in a machine that's designed to accept other things, such as a bill or a token. For example, the coin changing machines are becoming popular now, where you can insert a bill and actually get coins in return. So it would be intended to cover that type of situation also. This section is taken from the Michigan proposed draft, and that in turn is based on the New York statute. The difference in our approach is that we did not provide for different degrees of the crime. They had a more serious offense if you make or possess slugs in excess of $100 in value. We felt that for most purposes that one statutory crime would be sufficient in this state.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Judge Burns.
If my understanding, not only coin changers, but some of the machines that you occasionally see in Nevada and elsewhere, and I guess some of the vending machines, coffee machines, and so on, have this a bill,
yeah.
Dollar bill, and so forth, which I take it is included in Section 9. And yet, wouldn't that also be covered by your definition of a falsely made written instrument? And I wondered if this had been covered. In other words, suppose it's a dollar bill, let's say, and it's falsely made so as to be a slug. Wouldn't it also be a forgery type written instrument which is falsely made? Well, like counterfeiting, in
yes.
effect. And I wonder if perhaps this doesn't create a perky type situation to have it in both sections.
Would this be a lesser included crime?
I don't know. In other words, if you utter it, presumably you'd utter it by putting it in the machine to tender and to publish and so on, and it'd be a crime under the forgery section, and similarly it'd be a crime here of he inserts, deposits, or otherwise uses, and so forth.
Is that necessarily bad, assuming everything you say is true?
I assume that you might not be using the same type of penalty for unlawfully using slugs as you would for forgery. Anytime you have a different penalty for essentially the same set of facts, you've got a perky problem. Or I think you have.
Well, of course, now here in this section.
Necessarily. Money. I mean, I don't know how a dollar changer
doesn't work back
works, but you wouldn't necessarily have a dollar. You'd have something of the same size and texture, maybe no written.
Could have, though.
Bill, you certainly could.
Well, the intent that's required under this section is an intent to defraud the supplier of property or a service sold or offered by means of a coin machine. So you have some additional guidelines to, with respect to this particular crime. Why would this be any more of a perky problem than say larceny in a store, which could also amount to shoplifting?
I don't think it is.
And the Supreme Court,
you have an additional element here. It has to be a coin machine.
Well, if he utters a written instrument which he knows to be forged with intent to injure or defraud, he's guilty of forgery in the second degree. And if he...
This is another means of uttering one, in other words.
Sure, because uttering is uttering, whether it's handing a check across the check stand to the clerk, or whether it's putting the bill in the vending machine. Isn't that uttering? Maybe it
is. Mr. Chairman, I don't think we have a perky problem here because we have the added element of the machine itself.
That's what I mean.
And so there's a different standard or criteria.
Well, John, I don't think so, though. Subsection B, Section 9, he makes it, possesses it, offers it for sale.
Well, maybe so. Let's look at it.
It's disjunctive.
Yeah, but it goes on to say to use it fraudulently in a coin machine.
To use it fraudulently.
Well, we don't. But then you're saying that intent to use it in the coin machine would take it out of the forgery situation?
Well, no. Take it out of the turkey problem.
A DA couldn't indict under subsection B of section 9 for both forgery and for this? If a person makes a bill for the purpose of using it in a coin machine, makes it look like a dollar bill?
Yeah, he probably could.
Doesn't that
or
create...
Or he could do either. I mean, he if it's a coin machine...
If you well, do either one, that's
that's the thing. If Section 9 is a misdemeanor...
Not necessarily.
No.
And you got the additional
element of the coin.
This of using it in a coin.
John, notice a good brief on perky.
Defense attorneys like to raise perky, but it is a very situation.
See, because perky doesn't presently attach to the larceny in a store
petty larceny situation, or any one of a number.
There's still a difference between assault and murder.
Yeah.
What Perkey gets at and what Perkey proscribes is the situation where the same facts can amount to either a misdemeanor or a felony, and the district attorney or the grand jury is free to arbitrarily choose either one without any appropriate guidelines, without anything set out to guide their discretion. And there have been a number of cases. There was a case involving shoplifting as opposed to larceny in a store. The question was raised that on appeal that this was a violation of equal protection because he could be charged either with larceny in a store or petty larceny or shoplifting.
Well, isn't Perkey the NSF case the only case that the Supreme Court has really said violates Perkey?
Yeah,
I mean,
because the exact same conduct with all of the ways of committing it.
Yeah.
We're left up to the DA to use this.
But in the Perkey case, there was an NSF statute, just simply out and out NSF, and the district attorney or the grand jury could charge in their discretion either the felony NSF or the misdemeanor NSF without any difference in the wording of the statute at all.
Right.
It was simply whether they wanted to charge felony or misdemeanor.
And you're right, though, too, that there have been probably 7 or 8 cases since Perkey in which the Perkey issue has been raised, and
the
Supreme Court has held each time it didn't apply. I mean,
they like to raise it, but they don't get very far with it.
I think this would be another example of where they would attempt to raise it. But every time there's a new judge in Multnomah County, I try to raise it.
Sure. I mean, that's
why so many cases get to the Supreme Court.
That's why they want to do court.
Any further discussion?
I don't think it would be for court of appeals, you guys raising this question.
I don't think so either.
That's right.
Nobody really wants that.
Any further discussion?
The word possession again, this particular crime, you want to do something with that?
Well, isn't that tied directly with intent to defraud, however?
Yeah.
Well, of course, that's what makes possession criminal anyhow.
Possesses with intent to enable a person to use it fraudulently. And we didn't have that characteristic in the Section 4 that
we
were talking about.
May I ask then, if that's going to be a decision, then why wasn't possession of a credit card made part of the definition? Did you think about that specifically and decide that you didn't want possession to apply there?
That's the next section,
yeah.
Joe.
Well, let's go to that, and then we can come back to Section 9 if we want.
I'm just raising the question, thinking there's perhaps an inconsistency. If you make possession with intent to defraud of slugs, then why don't you make possession with intent to defraud of credit card?
Next.
I don't see it in there, perhaps I misheard. I still have the...
I see the point.
The possession of slugs ought to be treated as a general possession question, as an instrumentality of crime.
I agree with Professor Platt. I think wherever possible, we ought to throw these possessions
a person has a
crime. You may decide
this
to treat them
use
specifically
the
later,
right.
But I think...
The other one's fraudulent using slugs, too, that's right.
Yeah, we have that same factor in both of them. It's absent in the credit card, but present here.
Well,
I put it in both places.
You could do it in Section 10, though, then, couldn't you? Most easily.
Yeah.
You've covered both use and possession with intent to use.
There was no reason for it, George.
Well, where's the counsel going to come in?
Can we?
Possession, George. Preparation, attempt, or this type of thing. Where is the penalty provision of that going to come in? How does that look like? I mean, we may want to make possession of a forged instrument. I mean, one type of crime may be the same as forging it, but possession of a slug would be a different type of a penalty.
Yeah.
Possession of burglar tools would be a different type of a penalty. Possession of other things as far as the attempt. Now, is the penalty for attempt going to be directly related to the principal offense, or is it going to be set off somewhere with a different penalty? I mean, how is it done in the model?
Without a dissertation on the problems of inchoate crimes, I would say as briefly as I can that the crime of possession is generally viewed not as the crime of attempt, but possession is defining as something as criminal in order to allow the police to intervene at a time more at an earlier time than they would be with respect to the definition of the crime of attempt. In other words, possession is not generally equated with the crime of attempt. Now, this gets me to my direct answer to you. The penalty provisions for the crime of attempt, attempted robbery, attempted murder, attempted rape, is set out with respect to it's equated to the principal offense.
Right.
Possession of slugs or weapons or anything else is designated currently a misdemeanor in the code. In other words, it's not related to the principal offense for the simple reason, or at least for the major reason, because it's not close enough yet to completed conduct to warrant the higher penalty. This is the policy view.
Okay, but then there are certain instances, at least, that I feel for.
Is that right to answer your question?
No.
Should be related to the completed crime. Like, say, possession of a forged check with the intent to pass it.
Possession of this credit card.
Should be greater than the simple misdemeanor. I mean, this guy isn't the one who forged it, so you couldn't charge him with forgery, but he is in possession of it, and you have to have it with the intent to pass it.
No, I recognize that.
But I think there are certain possession situations that should be related to the crime, where it's made a principal crime to possess or use it.
Of course, we're going to get to that when we get to the point where we start putting labels and classifications on
them.
We're
going to
have to consider that all in the whole.
I would almost be favored of leaving the word possession in the principal things as we're going through them. And then if we see that it should fall back, we feel that possession of a slug, say, should fall back into the general possession definition, be treated as a misdemeanor or whatever the penalty for possession turns out to be. Delete it from the principal offense and throw it back in there rather than throwing them all back in there now.
Well, as I understand it, we're not throwing it out here in Section 9, Frank, and we did in Section 8.
But we just
Frank.
Did in the forgery situation.
Yeah, but yeah. Where we had possession alone without making or possessing.
We kicked it out, yeah.
Yeah.
But we get into a question of philosophy, which really relates to the topic of grading of offenses. When we take that up,
possession of certain things should carry a greater penalty maybe than possession of other things. And if there's no...
The reverse of that, Frank, you could argue, forcefully the other way on that, is if you equate the actual using of the slug or the completion of the crime with possession, and look at the professional's mind, professional criminal who does weigh these things, and he says, well, the penalty is the same whether I use it or possess it, therefore I'm not going to be deterred, I'll use it. If the penalty is made much lighter for possession, philosophically at least, or theoretically, he has that place of repentance, and he thinks to himself, it's considerably to my advantage not to complete this crime because I know that possession of this slug is a misdemeanor. Therefore, I'll keep it in my pocket and not use it. This is perhaps, I don't know how convincing that is to anybody, but this is one of the responses to trying to make stronger, the penalties for possession.
Well, but the thing that is, I think that many times it's much more difficult to prove that the who the individual was who used this slug. But when you catch him with a bunch of them, you got him in possession of them. And not only carrying them around, I mean, a sack full of slugs, just
paperweights.
Weight down his pocket. He's got a paper for some reason.
Well, but Frank,
this is really a good example because probably the using the slugs would be in the misdemeanor category and it wouldn't make any difference on the, as far as the penalty is concerned, whether it's in here with the principal crime or we're back in the possession thing. But there are certain things where the possession of would probably be in the felony classification.
But one of the most commonplace of all felonies is burglary. And traditionally, possession of burglar tools is generally a misdemeanor. And this shoots your argument. However, not that there isn't some logic and merit to the argument, and I rather suspect that we're going to fight this thing out later. I'm not sure that this is the appropriate time to do it.
Possession of a narcotic drug is a greater penalty than actually using it. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Sure.
Well, I don't think that's right. I don't think we should accept that in determining the policy here. Let's remember, actually we're talking about philosophy. Perhaps it isn't the time to talk about it. I think these are the things that the Subcommittee on Inchoate Crimes should be considering, frankly. That's why I suggest that all these possession things, at least if you leave the language in, be inserted with the condition subsequent that it may come out, depending on the decision in the Inchoate Crimes argument.
Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, could I try to answer Professor Plack's question about why we had possession in Section 10 but not in Section, or in Section 9 but not in Section 10? On page 28 of the commentary, we addressed ourselves to that. We felt that the card, in the case of the credit cards, that it would amount to property and that stealing it would be theft and possessing of a stolen card would probably be theft by receiving if you were in possession of a stolen credit card. And that forgery of a credit card or possession of a forged credit card under the definition of written instrument, that it would be covered under the major forgery sections. Of course, we've taken now, we've deferred any action on possessing of a written instrument. but that was the reason why we didn't put it in.
That's very good.
We didn't feel that there was, because of that, a need for a separate provision for theft or forgery of a credit card. We intended credit cards to be covered under our definitions.
Of course, I agree with Professor Platt that we took out Section 4 and 5, and there the gist was possession with the intent to utter.
Mm-hmm.
Now here in Section 9, it's possession with the intent to enable a person to use it for product. I don't see there's any real difference.
Well, actually, though, in Section 4, there wasn't with any intent to utter, was there?
No, not any.
Possesses with the intent to utter.
Yeah, under 4.
Well, otherwise, possession, you can't be a crime.
You've got to have something to do with it.
Sure, right.
Possessing crowbars and so forth isn't a crime. You've got to possess it with the intent to utter.
Oh, yeah.
Crime.
Yeah.
Really what we're talking about, the mens rea.
But on the other hand, I think that until Professor Platt completes his draft and that subcommittee looks at it, we can't really make an intelligent choice, and we really are making a philosophical choice whether we want to put it there or here. We can't really make that choice intelligently.
Well,
when we were trying to get at possession of slugs, this was intended to reach really the manufacturer, the operator who makes these for sale to other people, and that I think we're talking about a little different type of animal here than someone who possesses a single forged document or something to commit a crime. Here we've got a supplier, really, of slugs, and that this was intended to cover this situation where you might have trouble proving that this individual made these slugs, but you could prove he was in possession of them with an intent to sell them to somebody else who would in turn use them in a machine. So there is a little different type of conduct that we're trying to get at here.
Well, how would we be if we just deleted the word possess here, possesses, tossed that into the subcommittee to with respect to inchoate crimes, then would this be satisfactory?
I'm not positive that it adds to it by taking it out of here, because if he possesses it with intent to use it fraudulently in a coin machine, he's charged with possessing a slug with intent to use it fraudulently in a coin machine. How do you prove this intent to use it fraudulently? Do it by scheme, pattern, by evidence of similar type crimes. And if we're going to put the element of possession over in the inchoate crime section, we're going to have to take this whole qualifying phrase along with it in order to permit the district attorney to prove to get this kind of proof in. I don't think it does violence to the inchoate crime concept in this instance to leave it here.
And you have the same situation about that criminal simulation thing.
Yes.
So I think that it's more appropriate if it belongs here if it's going to be prescribed at all.
I do too.
Is there any further discussion? What does the majority of this commission think with respect to whether we should retain the possession or omit it and pass it over to the inchoate crime section? Is that a motion? A motion has been made that the word possesses be retained in section 9. Those in favor, raise their right arms.
My right arm's sore.
Opposed? No opposition. Motion carried. Do you want to move on to section 10?
Yeah.
I take it we are approving the 10.
We're going to have to go back and approve each section with the exceptions of 4, 5, and 6, yes.
Okay.
Now, with respect to section 10, I've cited on page 27 some language from the Model Penal Code commentary I think was very appropriate with respect to their section on this, and they indicated that this is a new section to fill a gap in the law relating to false pretense and fraudulent practices. They point out that they have sections covering theft of property or services by deception. Then they go on to say it's doubtful whether they reach the credit card situation because the user of a stolen or canceled credit card does not obtain goods by any deception practiced upon or victimizing the seller. The seller will collect from the issuer of the credit card, because credit card users assume the risk of misuse of cards in order to encourage sellers to honor the cards readily. Thus, it is the non-deceived issuer who is the victim of the practice. And this section 10 is based on Model Penal Code 224.6 and the Michigan Code. The intent is stated to injure or defraud is the same as that we had in our forgery sections. The existing statute, ORS 165-300, requires an intent to defraud. And our definition of credit card is an amended version of what's in the statute now, 165.290. We have three existing statutes covering credit card crimes now on the books. 165-290 defines the terms credit card and cardholder. 165-295 deals with unlawful taking, procuring, possession, alteration, or use of a credit card. 165-300 prohibits the fraudulent use of a revoked or canceled card. And then, as I indicated earlier to Professor Platt, the comment upon why we didn't have possession of a stolen credit card or forged card included in this section. And that what remains is the really the gist out of 165-300. The subcommittee wanted to specifically point this out to the commission that the existing statute provides for misdemeanor punishment if it's under $75. That is the total amount of services or goods obtained, and felony if it's over 75 is like larceny. And the subcommittee felt that the similar grading should be included in the case of a credit card.
Except we haven't made any decision, Mr. Chairman, on what the line is going to be between a felony, or, you know, it might be $25, it might be $150.
Any discussion on Section 10? Looks like a dandy to me.
Maybe I ought to correct the record. I didn't.
Somebody's getting hungry.
Go on to the next one.
I correct the record. I was saying that.
Now, the next one's rather, you know, going to be a long one.
Well, why don't we break off for lunch?
I am
approval of those that we've passed upon. Dave Frost had some objections to written instrument. Section 1, definition. Are you ready to vote on whether that is acceptable?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that we move to at this time to adopt this with our prior agreement that, however, that the subcommittee was going to re-examine this definition of troubling.
Yes. Case. Yeah. As a matter of fact, even after we have adopted these formally, if we see something that's inconsistent or improper, we'll go back over them again.
We haven't lost jurisdiction.
No. All those in favor of approving Section 1, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Section 2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I can't turn the pages that fast, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Section 3.
As amended.
Yes, as amended.
Aye.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Section 4 is out. Section 5 is out. Section 6, when I get to it, is out. Section 7. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Section 8.
As amended.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Section 9. As it is. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Section 10.
Aye.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Very well. What time would you like to reconvene? 1:30?
Yeah.
This argument can be made for not even having a specific statute with respect to bank checks, particularly since under our comprehensive theft statute that we've drafted, obtaining property by means of a false check would be theft by deception. But there are some other advantages to having a bad check statute as such that were pointed out by the Model Penal Code reporters. And that one, of course, is that you don't have to actually obtain any property under the bad check statute in order for a crime to be committed. And also, there you have certain prima facie evidence factors written into the law. Then Michigan went on to state in their draft that they felt their approach emphasized the protection of the system of negotiable paper itself. That because checks are so widely used, that there's sound reason for taking care of, being able to take care of them with these prima facie evidence provisions. Now, we anticipated in the subcommittee that this section would amount to a misdemeanor, and that the serious crimes, where there's a lot of money obtained as a result of it, would go ahead and be handled and prosecuted under theft by deception. The Michigan approach here is, with respect to the definitions, I felt was a good one, and that is that since we're talking about negotiable instruments, that as far as definitions are concerned, that we incorporate by reference the Uniform Commercial Code definitions. Now, this is somewhat of a departure, I suppose, from what you normally find in a penal statute. But because of the nature of the crime, and we are talking about negotiable instruments, and we felt that the uniformity would be desirable. Now, the prima facie evidence factors are not new. Of course, we have those, as you probably know, under our present statute. Our language is a little different than 165-225. But and then we have a 10-day provision here under 2B. This received a great deal of discussion in the subcommittee. Now, I'd like to point out that 2B is not intended to prohibit prosecution of a check charge if the 10 days haven't elapsed. But it's just that, as far as the prosecutor is concerned, the prima facie evidence provisions wouldn't come into play unless the 10 days had elapsed. And in most cases, probably the district attorney wouldn't be getting into the case anyway if that amount of time hadn't gone by. But you could have situations where we recognize that you might have a case without it. You wouldn't have a strong case. But in order to avoid any confusion on that, on page 33, I stated that under the prima facie evidence provisions, the state meets its initial burden of proving intent if it shows either that the issuer of the instrument had no account with the drawee, or that the instrument was not made good within 10 days after receipt of a notice of dishonor. This does not mean that the state cannot prosecute until after the 10-day period has elapsed, but merely that a prima facie evidence provisions are not available until this time has gone by. Now, we make a rather important change with respect to the existing check laws on the question of what kind of an intent are we talking about, and that is that this draft is geared to an intent or a knowledge that the check would not be honored. So, for example, if you have an individual who writes a check on Friday with not enough money in the bank on Friday to pay it, but intending to have money in the bank when the check is presented for payment, under this draft, no crime would be committed. You could say that we're legitimizing the kiting of checks, I suppose you could say. But and some of the other comments in these other codes actually go that far to say that this is a common practice, and that the fraudulent intent is what you're getting at. And if there's no intent to defraud the person to whom the check's given, that you shouldn't have a crime. Now, under existing law, it's a different situation.
Is a crime now if you intend to have the money in by Monday?
Well, you have to have an intent to defraud, yeah, but...
And if you intend to have it there by Monday, and you have an intent to defraud.
Well, yeah, but there's more to the statute than that, though, Frank. The knowledge element now is knowing at the time of the making, drawing, uttering, or delivering, that the maker or drawer has not sufficient funds in or credit with the bank to pay it. So the intent, the knowledge now is knowledge that you don't have the money in there at the time the check is drawn. That's the knowledge of it. 165-225.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Land.
Just a general question, John. This read-in language, negotiating a worthless negotiable instrument,
but it's got to be
and then using it, person
knowing at the time.
I'm sorry, I didn't. A person commits the crime of negotiating a worthless negotiable instrument, and you go on, and all the language talks about drawees, drawers, and so on, which makes it pretty apparent that you're talking mainly about drafts and bank checks. And why then go that a negotiable instrument could be a promissory note,
yeah,
which doesn't the terminology doesn't fit here. You don't have a drawee for a promissory note. you don't have a draw E for various other kinds of negotiable paper. But are you talking about anything more than a draft or a bank check in connection with this? Or is that what this is?
Well, that's mainly what it's aimed at, but certainly it was intended to cover other negotiable instruments besides. But the prima facie evidence provisions probably wouldn't apply in the case of a promissory note or something like that, although it's...
Part that will not be honored by the drawee. Supposing that I've got a negotiable one and a promissory note and I get rid of it, and although I know that it's not going to be honored by the maker.
Well, the language is geared mainly to checks. There's no question about that. But
I just wondered if you might, since you're using draw E as the term up here in your subsection 1, what you'd have to be able to point to a draw E in order to have the crime committed.
How does the statute define negotiable instrument? 731040.
Well, it includes a whole range. Yeah. Checks.
Range of bills and notes.
Yeah.
Old time definition.
If you get into this, you see the problem I get. If you can't point to a draw E, you can't have a crime. And if you meant to cover promissory notes and other paper other than bank checks and drafts, I think that you've got too narrow a statement of it here.
As far as the intent element. Uh-huh.
Well, that's the prima facie evidence.
No, that's under one.
Sub one.
Where does it say draw E?
Very last word.
My tapes have covered up the last.
Well, I think it's meant to cover the whole thing, but we're really just thinking in terms of...
Yeah, I think you've got a good point.
The Michigan code does the same thing.
Now, this is taken from Michigan.
It will not be honored. That's the way mine was written with the table. It's just the expectation that it will not be honored.
I'd be curious if we did it that way.
Wouldn't that do it?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that do it?
Yeah. And that's the way mine was with the table.
We ought to thank the secretaries for helping us on that.
How was it before?
Maybe just strike by the drawing.
Instead of saying by the draw, why not on present?
Yeah, I
think it'd be better.
Well, is presenting though a limiting word?
It is too.
Does presentment have some connotations that might be restrictive?
Yeah, what's 50-40 say there?
50-40. How presentment made, 50-40. Presentment is a demand for acceptance or payment made upon the maker, acceptor, drawee, or other payor by or on behalf of the holder. Presentment may be made, A, by mail, in which event the time of presentment is determined by the time of receipt of the mail, or B, through a clearinghouse or place designated by the party who is to pay or accept, or C, at the place of acceptance or payment specified in the instrument if there is none, at the place of business or residence of the party to accept or pay, if neither, so on and so forth. It goes on and on and on.
Seems pretty broad.
Yeah, presentment would do it.
You know, you've got a lot of excess language also in the definition of negotiable instrument, 731040, including sub 3, which says, as used in other sections of the Uniform Commercial Code, and as the context may require, the terms draft, check, certificate of deposit, and note may refer to instruments which are not negotiable within ORS 7310, which is the commercial code, as well as instruments which are so negotiable. Would it be easier to say check? Because that's what we're talking about.
Well, Don made the first point, though, that they weren't just trying to limit this.
Yeah, that's right. We weren't. That's why we incorporated these other definitions by reference here. We wanted to take care of other types of instruments other than just checks.
Mr. Chairman, a little further down, though, I was looking at the definition of time of presentment towards the creation of the prima facie evidence of the intent. Time of presentment is very strict on the commercial code and how it's made. I think you're building a defense, whereas before you had to defend to overcome the presumption by trying to show there were circumstances which indicated the person at the time of giving the check really had money there. His wife threw it out, or the bank put it in another account or something like that. Here you're giving a real good defense on just the time of presentment, whether or not the presentment was proper. Because if by a bank has to be before midnight, the midnight deadline, if by an individual within 3 days,
what you're saying is we're creating problems by having the commercial code definitions?
I think you're creating a good defense.
Well, but this is a prima facie.
Yeah, but if you can beat down the time of presentment, if you can beat the presentment, you've beaten the prima facie, haven't you?
Well,
then you've got to prove specific things.
Well, yeah, you'd need some other evidence.
Yeah, but this is...
We've done more than
that. It's been my experience that with the... I mean, now we have the prima facie that if it's dishonored, it's prima facie, it doesn't mean it's a damn thing anyway. I mean, you've got to show a series of checks or something to show the intent of the fraud, something more than just simply that the check was dishonored. It gets you past the judgment of will, gets you to question of fact.
You just have the banker come in, at least in our area, with the ledger card. Show on that date when the check was presented that there weren't sufficient funds. But here, aren't you going further and saying there was a necessity for notice to be given?
Yeah, and
before you create the presumption.
Well, yeah. Well, if I could speak to that. Here's the thing, not only the model penal code, but the modern view on these things is that you ought to be pretty cautious in writing prima facie provisions into criminal statutes, and in those cases where you do create a prima facie case against a defendant, that you should limit it strictly, and this is purposely done under the Michigan draft to make it difficult to have a prima facie case, and I'm not so sure that's necessarily bad. We're not talking about letting people go. We're just saying, well, as far as the state's concerned, we're just not going to make it as easy for them to get to a jury without some other evidence in a given case. And of course, this is a policy question, but the feeling has been, I think, in the subcommittees, not only on this section, but in for example, with respect to theft of services, we had some prima facie evidence provisions in there, and attempting to limit them much more severely than they are under present Oregon statutes with respect to an intent to defraud when you abscond, for example, you abscond from a hotel or a restaurant without paying. That present statute has a long list of things which create a prima facie case, and we took six in the subcommittee and the commission also finally, we ended up with one, only one thing that would create a prima facie case. So I'd just like to point that out. We're not talking about not making it a crime, we're just talking about not making it as easy to create a case of guilt.
Mr. Chairman, I have two comments. Mr. Frost brought to mind that fail to make good apparently is a phrase of art used in negotiable instruments. It's not really English, but I suppose that has meaning. I wonder, I have a tortured fact situation, but it actually happened in Salem. It would fit in here, and I grant you it would allow the district attorney to have a prima facie case. A fellow drew a check, and at the same time lien was put on his bank account was garnished. The check cleared and bounced, and he didn't have the money to pungle up to pay off his check. So he would not have qualified under this. In other words, the state would have a prima facie case for crime. Now, of course, one might say, well, he can go to the jury and so on, but I wonder, and if this is a tortured situation, where at the time you wrote the check, it was satisfied, but after the check was written, before it was presented, his bank account was wiped out substantially by a debt, in this case owed IRS, and he wound up with a rubber check. You require him to pay it off within 10 days, or the state's got enough to go to the jury.
Well, the only, as they would have a prima facie case, but unless they could show and convince the jury that at the time of the uttering or delivering, he had the expectation, he knew that the lien was going to be placed, his bank account was going to be wiped out, that he would not be guilty.
No, but I object to giving the state a prima facie case that flies in the face of fact. Now, your answer is that he can overcome the fact by the truth. My answer would be that don't give a prima facie case.
All right, but you've got the situation now that any time an NSF check bounces, the state's got a prima facie case.
Exactly.
But
and I'm not arguing
that any time an NSF check bounces certainly doesn't mean you're going to get any conviction.
No, but that's another hour or two of my sermon on bad checks, which I won't suffer you to today.
I've heard it.
Yes, probably never. But I'm just concerned that
several times, and I probably agree with you wholeheartedly.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure whether we're going to get into the policy arguments here, but I think we ought to bear in mind what we heard from Mr. Rubin about a year ago. Made some very persuasive statements. The whole philosophy of this area. I'm not sure today is the day to bring it up.
I think they should, and I want to say something on that too, Jim.
Well, sooner or later, I think we ought to sit down and, and confront the
people. I think this is the time, probably, when we're considering this very statute.
One reason it brings to my mind the experience that customarily we used to have in Harney County was that fellows would buy a load of hay in Harney County and pay the rancher for the hay and head over to Tillamook or someplace to sell it or wherever they sold it over in the valley and hoping that they could go faster than however the checks were being transmitted through the various banks. And inevitably they didn't get there quite as quick from time to time, and I had a hot rancher on my hands and saying, I want to put this bird in jail. And frankly, I have great doubt whether the David's got any business in that
ballpark. Yeah, I want to second that. I think that we should give consideration to what a burden this check prosecution is on the district attorney's offices and on the penal institutions. I think you will find, if you check out at the penitentiary, that usually between one-third and one-half of the inmates in the penitentiary and the correctional institution, particularly the penitentiary, are check people. And I think that this matter was explored quite extensively in a conference, a check conference, about 3 years ago that was largely sparked by Justice Denneke. It's been a matter of some discussion in the Crime Control Council as well. But basically, I think we should give consideration as to whether or not we should take a large portion of these NSF cases out of the criminal justice system entirely, and to make some restrictions such as that there will be no criminal prosecution unless there's a showing, number one, that the person who took the check exercised reasonable diligence and inquiry as to the identity of the individual and the existence of a bank account. Then if it wasn't, then it doesn't go through the criminal justice system, and we don't provide free board and room at the penitentiary for X number of inmates, and it's a big problem.
Well, you take a supermarket, Bob, people come in there, and many, many, many of them pay by check, and they ask them to see their driver's license and perhaps other identification. They accept the check. What precautionary steps do you think should be taken if they can't call the bank, hold all the rest of the customers and call the bank if so-and-so have an account? What would you suggest?
I just threw out two suggestions. Number one, there'd be no criminal prosecution unless they're showing of a reasonable inquiry as to the identity of the individual and the existence of account. Otherwise, let them go. There'd be a big row on this for the merchants. But you talk to the DAs, and they'll tell you how much of their time is spent in effect, running a collection business for the merchants. Now, maybe this is part of what the criminal justice system should sustain as a service to the merchants, a collection service. But when we've got the DA's time, the court's time so needed in other fields, whether we should be in this thing. Just the same fundamental policy questions involved with taking drunks out of the criminal justice system.
Well, we have it with shoplifting. In the obvious bad check case, it is, shoplifting is no more reprehensible than that bad check. I don't feel. Harl?
Maybe there'd be some type of compromise in the area where, rather than put this type of burden on the merchant, to have in the statute, rather than having the conduct we complain of occur at the time the check's given, that we'd say something like, knowledge or expectation that it will not be honored within a reasonable time or within 10 days or something like that. Well, I see, but I think that I don't think that we should expect a merchant to run a credit check on everyone.
Down there, I just catch hell when I won't prosecute on. I won't pay a check.
I think it'd be wouldn't it be an easier case if someone had 10 days to.
I think that's the Kansas statute, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's the Kansas statute.
More problems. Because then you'd have this additional 10-day time that the guy could say, well, would be able to say, well, I intended to have money in the bank by Monday when I got there, is what they can say now. Now they'd be able to say, well, I thought I was going to start to work by Monday, and I knew I'd be able to get a draw on Friday, and so I was going to get that money into the bank the following Monday. And then as it turned out, I got sick Sunday night, didn't start work Monday, so it opens up the...
Doesn't change anything, what you're saying. It doesn't open anything up. It doesn't change anything.
Yes, it does. It enlarges the stories that they can come up with, their excuses.
Bud?
I did this somewhat facetiously. It was either two or three sessions ago when the AOI, I think, and some of the DAs were around trying to change the bad check law so that they could extradite people that apparently they couldn't extradite under existing law. And some of these merchants were pretty candid about the fact that they take these calculated risks, that they don't get all the identification they need, and that they cash checks when they know it's being questionable, and they're taking a chance, but that this, in the overall business picture, is good for them, because they keep the money coming in, they serve the customer makes his purchase, and he gets out. They're taking a calculated risk, and I made a suggestion that sort of goes along here a little bit at the time, right at the top of my head, it was, well, maybe what we ought to do is have everybody who's going to cash checks have to have a license to do it, like he has to do for selling liquor. And the first time he cashes a bad one and reports it to the DA, he loses his check cashing license for 30 days. And then maybe the next time 90 days, and then he loses it forever. And it's a little facetious, but it's going way over. Well, but the point is, you see what I'm getting at? There is an idea there. These people, and you can't hold up the line in the supermarket, right, Tony? But on the other hand, these people are taking a calculated risk, some of the paper they take in. I've seen the guy ahead of me stand there and probably right. Truthfully saying, well, the reason that I got a different address on my check than on my driver's license is that I forgot to notify the Department of Motor Vehicles and this sort of thing. And they say, well, do you have any other kind of identification? Well, maybe he's got a Social Security card in which he's, the middle initial is different or something, but he's got an explanation for that, and they finally cash the damn thing because they want to make the sale. And
on the other hand, if you did that, you'd really just be inviting bad checks, and you'd really stop commerce to a large extent.
All
these people who buy depend upon their checks.
One of the things that's always kind of hurt me is if I find myself in an area where I'm not known, and I walk in to try and cash a check somewhere, and I present what I think are reasonable credentials, namely the Oregon State Bar card and my certificate of election, and none of them want to see those. They want to see the driver's license.
Of course,
secured thing. Maybe that's just a matter of petty pride, but this is typical, I think, of any place. They want to see the driver's license.
I was going to say, I one of my relatives who had trouble with this, he was not a malicious check artist, but he was very accomplished. He'd go into places that I couldn't cash checks, and he'd pass them boom, boom, right on out. It's those who do it as a more or less of a habit. Mm-hmm. They've got to batter down and show reams of materials. He just never had a bank.
We went fishing up into Idaho one time with the manager of the U.S. National at Ontario, myself, his son, and a pharmacist there, the four of us. His son was about 21. and three of us couldn't cash a check, but that 21-year-old boy did.
Jim's comment points out that they're more interested in being knowing the identity of the individual than whether or not it's a good credit.
Well, I think that's
use this approach.
That's the argument.
One of the interesting commercial approaches to what Bud is saying is this thing that Fred Meyer uses, where in effect you get a Fred Meyer credit card and then you can go in and you can cash a check at Fred Meyer's store, which has its share of the problem, certainly, considering the sort of operation it runs. But the idea there is you don't cash a you don't cash a check at Fred Meyer essentially unless you produce one of those cards. Now, I suspect, given the ingenuity of American commerce, that if we just left this section out, the businessman would respond appropriately and intelligently in a very short period of time, probably someone along the line that, that Bud suggests. After all, you're going to be getting one of these days to the point where you're probably not going to use very much money anyway, and maybe not very many checks except on some kind of computerized thing. But Fred Meyer can apparently do it.
Yeah, but how about that little tiny roadside grocery? They can't do it.
Well, that's the thing, like this check conference that Bob was talking about, I think that they're praying is a way to stop people from, you know, stores from taking bad checks was to not make it a crime, and then they would make sure that, they would not take checks from people that they knew that they could rely on being good and this type of thing, or they would be just simply assuming the risk as part of their business expense if they can afford to do that, like a large supermarket. But I don't necessarily agree with that, and I agree with the commentary here from the Model Penal Code that somewhere along the line you've got to protect the integrity of the commercial paper, and that, I think stores tend to treat checks more as money rather than a promise to pay money, and this is to have yet to protect commerce, and like you've got to have, they've got to be able to respect it.
I appreciate all these discussions and opinions, and something should be done, certainly, to, because that merchant's at fault so many, many times. He invites all of this. While we could do something in that area, I just don't think that we can insert a roadblock here into commerce, because when I go into a supermarket, half the women or the little gals there, they haul out their check, their names on it, and everyone's gotten to the point where they rely upon the use of a check to buy things.
Mr. Chairman, if we accept Berkeley's suggestion, we're going to have to go back to the credit card section and put another section in there for altering credit cards used to cash checks with. No, but may I make two observations, and I make these in the face of the argument that's made by the so-called enlightened approach to the subject of check writing.